The following Dharma talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel at the Zen Center of New York City, Fire Lotus Temple. Hojin Sensei is the abbot of the Zen Center and head priest at Zen Mountain Monastery.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to those of you who are here for the first time. Thank you for joining us. Buddhas and ancestors of old were as we. We in the future shall be Buddhas and ancestors. And this is a line I found from a verse that Dogen wrote called Arousing the Bodhisattva Vow. And he called it a chant or a prayer. Dogen is a 13th century Zen master. To express his gratitude for ancestors and the continuous guidance that we receive in our practice to be a benefit for all beings, that we need wisdom traditions and the wisdom passed on so we can be those ancestors for the future generations. We are those Buddhas and ancestors. We have a little library upstairs in our common room for residents. And we started a shelf. You know how in bookstores they put, this is what we're reading now, and somebody writes a little bit about it. So the one up was The Shamanic Bones of Zen by Zenju Earthlin Manuel. So I took it like as a person just walking in the store, even though I've read it before. And I had this feeling of ancestry on my mind, and I looked at Paula Arai's introduction, forward story. And she said, while reading the Shamanic Bones of Zen, I saw a documentary on elephants navigating ancient routes across the African continent in their annual migration between habitats with sufficient water. So they go from one watering hole to another, and they were on that migration. And she said they pass through harsh environments and finally they arrive at a watering hole. And when they got there this time, it had dried up. So they went all that way through all that hardship, and the watering hole had dried up. She writes, before despair set in, a mother elephant gently picked up a bone of an elephant who had not survived a past journey. She tenderly placed it to her calf to hold. This poignantly deliberate act conveyed the gravity of respecting forebears' humility in the face of nature's cycles and gratitude for the support of others. Safe passage depends on ritualized actions that intimately connect ancestors and living beings, imparting wisdom that transcends birth and death. In this sense, she said, the elephants are shamanic beings. So I think it matches Dogen's prayer and what she's saying, that we cannot do any of this work in our life entirely by ourselves, and recommends, as Dogen continues with the vow, respecting and requesting help from all Buddhas and ancestors. May they share with us their compassion. And some of us may have connection to ancestors, and some of us may not or be developing that. So this is from a lineage, as we chanted this morning, two lineages of awakened ancestors, a long lineage of awakened teachers. And we offer dedications and the merits to them. So last week, I didn't forget, I said I would speak about this ancestor Dogen, tell you a little bit about, since he's often mentioned. And for those of you who are new, this is a beginning of a 90-day training intensive we call Ango. And our theme is one of these chapters, or sometimes called fascicles, from his larger work called Shobogenzo. and it's the Genjo Koan, and it's translated as the way of everyday life. So it's our everyday life that we're working with, the way of our everyday life. And the koans that appear within our everyday life, the things that we need to, that come up, that we need to work with. So my teacher, Shugen Roshi, often speaks about how we're recipients of innumerable currents of life streaming in and influencing our own lives. We have our genetic lineage, our spiritual lineage. So how, what are ancestors? And might our connection to ancestors offer something vital to our lives? And how might we expand our understanding of ancestry? And it's interesting about all that we're doing, because we receive translations and it's not in the original place where it was written with the circumstances of that time, though there's similarities. And it's relying on translations from Chinese and Japanese. So this isn't a coffee table book. And we might hear things in it that are like, that sounds really good. But it's actually our life. And we have to take it up and practice it and really spend time to understand the Dharma. It's not easy to understand the Dharma. So as I learned about Dogen, you know, he actually wasn't, right now, he's a big influence. What we're doing today and how we run the Zendo and sit, this is from his teachings and offerings on how to deport ourselves and practice best in the Zen tradition. But when he was, at his time, I read from Botiford, he was not a very influential teacher. Nobody really knew about him. He was just a monk, right? And he wrote things, but nobody really knew about it. He never served as an abbot. He was, as I tell you a little of his history, he was from an aristocratic family, and he preferred to not be in an urban setting, so he always looked for remote settings. So his writings could have easily been forgotten or lost. But they were brought out and integrated into our present day life and across many schools. So I just wanted to say that he wasn't like always this highfalutin teacher that everyone knew about in his time. So our ancestral relationships might not even be limited to human beings. Thich Nhat Hanh said, as I look more deeply, I see that in a former life, I was a cloud. And I remember reading Octavia Butler, and she wrote about looking to the eyes of her first non-human being. I think she was, I don't know how old she was, maybe around five or not exactly. It was a copper spaniel named Baba. And her life completely shape-shifted its perspective and understanding of consciousness when she made eye contact with this dog. She wrote this about this aha moment. She writes, "My dog was someone else entirely when we made eye contact, not just an animal. I saw this profound interconnectedness, this inter-R, and realized, who was I then? Who was I then?" And that influenced all of her work. Of course, her whole life changed at that moment. Just in that Cocker Spaniel's eyes, what she realized. And to my mind, ancestors are everything. Everyone that existed on the planet before my birth, our births. The earth, the moon, stars, the mountains, the rivers, the plants, the single cells, the many cells, people in our blood lineage, loved or unloved, those we want to disown because we feel they did not walk with integrity or were harmful to others. Everyone's included. And their wrongful actions in ancestry have something to do with how we personally and collectively live. They too are ancestors. They're ancestors in the lineage of a spiritual practice, in the lineage of life itself. And all religious paths, I think, or spiritual paths are essentially, at their base, ancestral, come down. So Buddhism, as I said, is an ancestral wisdom tradition, and the practices of it go back to the time of the Buddha. He's the most revered ancestor. But Buddha himself knew of a stream of ancestors, and we even chanted this morning seven ancestors that were before Buddha. Bibashi Butsu Daisho, Shiki Butsu Daisho, Bishafu Butsu Daisho, Kugunini Butsu Daisho. These are all before we get to Shakyamuni Buddha Daisho. So a long list of ancestors from India to China to Japan to here now, honoring those who have upheld the teachings that open doors. As Zenju says in her book, let us be rattled by the bone in our bones by the ancestors, what lives already in our cells and in our pores. Truly, we are the children of the Buddha, we chant. And there was wisdom and Dharma before it landed in a human being. It's always been present. And Buddha revealed that to himself. But I think it's important when we get into ritual and ceremony to regard the people from the land where their teachings emerged as we're embracing Zen here now. Because if we don't take steps to honor our ancestors and the lineage, then it's like we're taking it for our own. And so everything really comes from someone, something that we receive. So this is why I think in the MRO, Mountains and Rivers Order, which we are, our changes are sometimes glacial. People think like, why can't you just change what we're doing? And it's like, we really take time because we have to look at why was it put there? Someone thought that was important. And so to say it in this way, to do it in this way. So we have to go back in history to see what was that based on so that we can learn where it originated and then see how does that meet today. And sometimes that is glacial, but it moves. I mean, we eventually, you know, got lists of women ancestors. That took, I don't know, 20 some years. So we can't just throw out what we don't understand, but we reverently bow and examine further. And of course, many spiritual traditions take time to and space to honor those who came before. We had a retreat. One of our students was studying with Maladoma Somme. He's from the Dogara people of Burkina Faso in Africa. And a very big part of their tradition is ancestry. And so he was working with us in America in deep ritual and ceremony. We all had to have photographs. We built a big altar. We shape-shifted the entire dining hall. We didn't have the Sangha house at that time, but we made the whole dining hall and the steps, the circular steps, into this whole ritual sacred space to do this ancestor work. And we enacted several ceremonies to keep bonds with them clear and strong. And we used all the elements present. And these are his words. He said, the deceased can become powerful allies once they are fully at home in the ancestral realm. He wrote, Dogara people's main job is to look the dead in the face, to treat their bodies, not as remains, but as temples of grace and beauty, continuing from this world to the other. People grieve the passing of loved ones. Though in this grief, they stress beauty, community, and continuity. The handling over of the loved one to the realm of the ancestors is what we call, this is still him, ancestralization. It allows for a sense of completion in the vast array of duties following the passing of a person. Addressing this issue of fulfilling our duties toward the dead in the interest of transforming restlessness into rest, discontinuity into continuity, and homelessness into homecoming, into sanctuary, as Senju would say. And maybe this is a very sharp contrast to those of us today who, I mean, somebody asked me, do you know the name of your great-grandparents? And I struggled. I don't know their name. I had to remember my grandparents' names. Some of us remember, let alone their presence in any substantive way, ongoing way. The Buddha always taught past and present are inextricably bound by the subtle threads of cause and effect. And our place in the world is not a given, we create it. As my teacher would say, we are all implicated. We're all exerting our power. The question becomes, how do we use this great power? So we have this opportunity in ritual and ceremony to activate justice together through collective awakening. We can hold our grief together in ceremony and ritual. And Buddhism, it's important to remember, arose from the flames of suffering among the people of India. It emerged from Siddhartha Gautama's suffering in a privileged life, where he encountered and saw and felt among his Shakya people, the poor, the aged, those dying from neglect, and all those he felt and questioned, what is this suffering? Do we have to suffer? How do we suffer? And just, that was his staying with that, to answer that. So in looking at the life of Zen Master Dogen, this isn't all of it, of course. I'm just going to give a brief overview where we see in every life of every master this noble truths operating. This declaration that life suffers. It's because of our thirst, our dissatisfaction, the three poisons of greed, anger, and delusion, having something we want, and then we don't want it. We want it, we don't want it, our wanting, our not wanting. We have it, we want to get rid of it, and that we can be free of suffering, and then the Eightfold Path. So Dogen follows that as well. And I first heard of Master Dogen before I came to Zen training. I didn't even know who he was. As many of you know, I have a background in the arts and in clay in particular. And I was very interested in self-glazing processes. And it turns out that there's a legend that this Shiro Zaimen Kagemasa Kato was said to be the founder of Seito pottery, which I was very interested in. And it came from China, the methods. And he was said to be on the boat with this fellow named Dogen on his trip in the Song Dynasty to China. And because Dogen wanted to get the teachings from the Chan tradition, and he wanted to get the glazes from the Chinese potters and bring it back to Japan. So apparently he and Dogen, I found out later, were related in this Kuga family, which Dogen came from. So it's kind of interesting. So when I got to ZMM and Daito Roshi was talking about this Zen master Dogen who went on the ship, I was like, oh my God, that's the guy that was with the potter. So here he is again, coming up. I followed that direction, but then there was this one. So he was born in 1200. And it was interesting to look at, what was happening around the world in different hemispheres in 1200. Here in the Northern Hemisphere, who was settling in, the Five Nations coming to agreement. But Dogen was in Japan from a noble family in Kyoto. And as I said, his father was a powerful aristocrat. His mom was from the Fujiwara family, which was a very influential clan in Japan. He was noted for eventually this his part in the Soto school, which we're a part of, for introducing the practice of Zazen, the seated meditation, particularly Shikantaza. And this emphasis on direct experience, meditation, the understanding of time, being time, and Buddha nature. The Mountains and Rivers Order came from his sutra, the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, which Daito Roshi loved. He, like many of us, he experienced impermanence at a very early life. His father died when he was 2, and his mother when he was just 7. So this death had a profound impact on him, and it's said that he at one point saw incense burning, and the smoke just brought up something in him about impermanence. And then at 13 years old, which doesn't happen here, he became a novice monk. And he came up with a question, which was became the driving force of his spiritual journey. It's, if all beings possess the Buddha nature, why must one practice in order to realize it? If we all have this complete nature, perfect and complete, lacking nothing, born with it, we'll die with it, nobody gives it to us, it's not a thing, why do we have to practice in order to realize it? And so he was dissatisfied with he was in the Tendai tradition first, and he was dissatisfied it wasn't answered. So he went to Isai, a monk who practiced Rinzai Zen in Japan, and then to his successor, Myo Zen. And it was with Myo Zen that he went on the ship to China in 1223. So he's 23 years old. Anybody here 23? Yeah. So your age, and he's going over deeply in the tradition to find out this question. And he went to several monasteries. Initially it said disillusioned with what he saw. He said Chan monks seem very laxed. And then in 1225 he met Jiantong Ruijing, who he chanted this morning, the abbot of Qingtong Monastery from the Kaldong school, which is a Chinese predecessor of the Soto school. And under Ruijing's guidance, Dogen had an opening, a big awakening during a meditation session, which he later described as casting off body and mind. The casting off body and mind. And that sort of provided the answer to his question that had troubled him for years. If we all possess the Buddha nature, why must one practice in order to realize it? Casting off body and mind. That's why. We bring in a lot of accumulation, and he's going to the heart of it, what must be cast off to see this nature. And he spent some years with Ru Jing in Japan, and in 1227, he came back to Japan, settled in Kenenji, wrote Fukan Zazenji, Recommendations for Zazen, outlining the importance of Zazen, offered instruction for proper practice. And he often said, Zazen is not a means to attain enlightenment, but that Zazen itself is enlightenment. That practice is an enlightened activity. The moment we turn to practice, whatever's going on for us, if we remember to practice, that's enlightenment. That's an enlightened mind to do that. So it kind of takes away that I'm going to get to this certain point and something's going to pop. It's right there. On your cushion, that moment you release a thought and you just say, okay, come back to my breath. Amazing. You could just go off. And we do for a while, but then we notice and we come back again. That's enlightened activity. That's enlightenment itself. And eventually he didn't like the urbanized area, and he went off to create Aheiji. And if he only knew, if anybody's been to Aheiji, there are stores and shops and restaurants right up to the front gate. So his remote monastery is right there next to town. And it's one of the major training centers in Japan, along with Sojiji. And then during this time at Aheiji, he began this extensively writing this Shobo Genzo. It's 90 chapters. And as it became revealed and started coming out, the depth of it, of course, everyone started to see that, and it was so helpful, and started to translate it. And here we are today, studying it, each ango. And then in 1252, Dogen became ill. Said probably with a chronic condition developing over a few years, and he continued to teach and write until his death in 1253. And then he appointed Koan Ajo as his successor. So it was a short but intensely productive life in terms of Dharma. It's kind of interesting because his death poem doesn't match the date. So I'm going to read it to you because it says, and maybe it's because the first year is not considered the birth year, but again, every piece of Dharma has, like, people get on one word, like you'll see when I read the beginning of Genjo Koan, this word, it starts with when. That has been volumes on this word, what was meant by when. It's so this is what I mean. This is study. This is Dharma study. Here's his death poem. For 54 years, having been illuminating the highest heaven, suddenly leaping beyond, breaking down the great thousand worlds, the entire body, without seeking anything, while still alive, falling down into the yellow spring. Ha! That's his death poem. For 54 years, having been illuminating the highest heaven, suddenly leaping beyond, breaking down the great thousand worlds, the entire body, without seeking anything, while still alive, falling down into the yellow spring. Ha! So we're studying this Genjo Koan. And this turns out to be what he put first, the first fascicle in the entire volume. It was finished, written in 1233. And interestingly, he gave it to a lay student named Koshoyo as a parting gift when he was going back to his home in Kyushu. So I thought, isn't this interesting for all you lay folks that this was so, like, who was this lay student? I couldn't find anything. As you see, I have a lot of work to do here, but why did he give it to a lay student? He was working with monastics, but he gave it to a lay person. And it's about experiencing the fundamental point of our existence in the here and now. Right? Dogen was big on this being time, that we're not outside of time. That our being is time. It's only happening in the present moment. That is being time. So it's said that the first four stanzas, which I'll read, are not only a summation of the Genjo Koan, but the whole of his teaching. So that first four stanza, even if you stay with that, the entire ango, said within that is his whole entire teaching. I was happy to hear he revised it and rearranged it several times. That was like, oh, you're not the only one that revises and rearranges several times. So we're not sure which edition we're actually receiving. And when we used to do these Shobo Genzo retreats, Hobai and Kondo, they were like our translators. They would bring a stack of books like this, both of them. And a word would come up and they'd be like, ch-ch-ch-ch. You know, it was like we'd look at one phrase for a while. So Genjo Koan, this word gen, means manifest, translated as manifest, present, actual, revealed, self-evident. And Jo is become, accomplish, attain, complete, perfect. It says the two characters together translate something as becoming manifest or immediately manifesting. Thus, such, immediately manifesting, such, this very moment. The presence of things as they are in themselves, untouched by our conscious strivings. That's Genjo. And it said that koan is a little differently than the Zen koan we might be familiar with, where there's a story, a seemingly paradoxical story situation that a student needs to resolve. But it's a case. And so it's case is closed in this very moment. The case is closed. So it's the Genjo koan is translated as the way of everyday life, this very moment as it is. Our life, the everyday life we lead, waking up in the morning, preparing a meal, sitting, going off to work, walking the dog, relating to people, getting in arguments, resolving arguments, wanting to solve things. That is our everyday life. And he's looking at what is reality that's beyond the dualities of absolute and relative, intrinsic and conventional, beyond their difference, beyond their oneness. So this is what he is doing in this fascicle, constantly shifting our perspectives in order to point to this one reality. The coming together of these two truths, bringing them up distinctively, the vastness, the ultimate, and the differences that emerge and how they come together. The commentator, we're using Mazumi Roshi's book, and the commentator writes, the motivation to practice is often this seeming paradox or tension between the intrinsic, the ultimate, the absolute, and the experiential, between the belief that everything is complete and perfect as it is, and the fact that we feel a deep satisfaction. That would be two of the things we hold. We know this completeness, and yet we're also dissatisfied with our lives and want to experience this completeness for ourselves. And ultimately, it's one reality. So this is the first four couplets that are said to contain all of Dogen's teachings that I'll leave you with. When all dharmas are phenomena or things, or when all dharmas are Buddha dharma, there are enlightenment and delusion, practice, life and death, Buddhas and creatures. When the 10,000 dharmas are without self, without any self nature, there is no delusion, no enlightenment, no Buddhas, no creatures, no life, and no death. The Buddha way transcends being and non-being. Therefore, there are life and death, delusion and enlightenment, creatures and Buddhas. Nevertheless, flowers fall with our attachment and weeds spring up with our aversion. And as our vision becomes clear, as we study just what's arising in our mind in Zazen and seeing the illusory nature of thoughts, and it loosens things for us a bit, where we see mind operating, it's all mind. The world becomes a world not of things, but interrelatedness. That each thing is complete in its dharma state. And we can experience this interrelatedness more and more clearly as our life goes on and reconcile these points of view and see their interrelatedness as such, as this very momentness. As ideas, we can't reconcile them, right? It's kind of opposed to a logical opposites. So how is Dogen showing us the ultimate points of view in these lines? How is he showing us different perspectives or points of view, which we can look at reality? Dualities can be helpful. There's a false duality, and then there's true dualities. You know, we have to set boundaries. Parents need to do that with their children. It's good to have a duality, but not as an absolute. It's not absolute. So how do we bring it into balance in our lives? So I'll end with another one of Dogen's poems for a flavor of his writing. To what shall I liken the world? Moonlight reflected in the dewdrops, shaken from a crane's bill. To what shall I liken the world? Moonlight reflected in dewdrops, shaken from a crane's bill. Attaining the heart of the sutra, the sounds of the bustling marketplace preach the Dharma. Good one for us in the city. Attaining the heart of the sutra, the sounds of the bustling marketplace preach the Dharma. So in our everyday life, as we lay in our bed and we hear sirens and this birds and the whole of it, all preaching the Dharma as such. So we'll see what happens with the Sangha bringing this up. We vow, this is Dogen's verse on arousing the Bodhisattva vow, we vow with all beings from this life on throughout countless lives to hear the true Dharma, that upon hearing it, no doubt will arise in us, nor will we lack in faith that upon meeting it, we shall renounce worldly affairs and maintain the Buddha Dharma. In doing so, the great earth and all living beings together will attain the Buddha way. Although our past evil karma has greatly accumulated, indeed being the cause and condition of obstacles in practicing the way, may all Buddhas and ancestors who have attained the Buddha way be compassionate to us and free us from karmic effects, allowing us to practice the way without hindrance. So you may want to call upon your ancestors to help. They need employment, so please give them some work to help us along. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about the Zen Center of New York City's programs, retreats, and residency, or to make a donation, please visit our website, zcnyc.org.